Hi, I'm Bruce Maples, publisher of Forward Kentucky, and before we get to today's interview, I need to share two or three things. First of all, the standard encouragement that if you like this video, please click the like button, and if you like the work we do, please click the subscribe button so you know when we post other videos. We have three playlists on our channel. One is Moving Kentucky Forward, which is for candidates and elected officials. One is The State of Kentucky, which is what this one is, which is supposed to be for people who are having some impact on the politics of Kentucky or on the state. And then the third one is Bruce's Take, which is my editorials done in video form. I need to explain something about today's interview. Normally, I try to keep the State of Kentucky, as I said, focused on things that affect Kentucky politics or affect the state. But I had a chance to interview a very fascinating person, and the more I read about this person, the more fascinating they became. And so this is not really directly related to politics in Kentucky or even directly related to the state. But I think you will find, as you watch or listen to the video, that it has some really meaningful thoughts and insights that do apply to politics and, frankly, to almost everything we're doing. So let's get on to the interview with Cory Doctorow.
This episode is brought to you by the Metropolitan Housing Coalition.
Did you know that nearly 1 in 4 Louisville households are energy burdened? The Metropolitan Housing Coalition's Every Home program continues to build bridges between affordable housing and affordable utilities. No more than 6% of your income should go toward energy bills, but many families pay far more. High energy bills can force families to choose between keeping the lights on and buying groceries, a choice no one should have to make. Together, we can make every home safe, healthy, and affordable. Learn more and get involved at everyhomelou.org.
So we're here today with Cory Doctorow. Cory, welcome to the State of Kentucky.
Thank you very much. It's been a while since I was there. And when I was there, I was in the bit that's actually technically Cincinnati. So. Okay.
Yeah, we consider Cincinnati sort of a stepchild city for the state here.
Yeah. It's Ohio with better bourbon stores.
Yes. Yes, absolutely true. I have to admit, when I first sent you the invitation to be interviewed, I was a little bit in awe because it's not every day that I get to interview somebody who invented the word of the year for one particular year. And then in preparation for today, I went and looked at your Wikipedia article, and now I'm completely in awe and probably speechless to go with it.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. Well, you know, they wouldn't let them put it on the internet if it wasn't true. So I stand behind every word.
That's great. So we have to start, obviously, with your word of the year, but there's a lot more I want to get to. In shitification, one of the greatest words and, frankly, greatest concepts I've ever come across. I have the article up here and I can read the text from where you said it. So let me do that to set the stage. And then I want you to go in to dig into it a little bit. Here is how platforms die. First, they are good to their users. Then they abuse their users to make things better for their business customers. Finally, they abuse these business customers to claw back all the value for themselves. Then they die. I call this enshittification, and it is a seemingly inevitable consequence arising from the combination of the ease of changing how a platform allocates value combined with the nature of a two-sided market where a platform sits between buyers and sellers, holding each hostage to the other, raking off an ever larger share of the value that passes between them. What a wonderful, insightful word. So, obviously, we all can sit here and think about enshittification, and we can think of a number of platforms that we would apply this to. Why don't you take us down your thought process about what got you to this?
Yeah, sure. So I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that it's a fun word and a good concept, because it's not just a word that's fun to say. And I think that if I had left it at that, if I just come up with a word that created a minor license to profanity, that it probably would have ended very quickly. But the word came in the midst of a lifetime 23 years now of working with the Electronic Frontier Foundation on what you might call digital human rights or digital rights. And broadly, that has been a campaign to get people to care about these very abstract technical questions that are eventually going to be very concrete when they're on their doorstep and destroying their lives, and trying to get people to care about this stuff before we get to that juncture. You know, and that's the name of the game, whether you're talking about the climate emergency or rising authoritarianism or you know, this stuff. I obviously have spent many years trying to figure out how to get kind of everyday people who don't have a lot of technical nuance in their understanding to kind of get their heads around this stuff. And when I combined the minor license to profanity with the technical analysis, I think that was the winning combination.
Yeah,
and it really did take off. It was Word of the Year in the U.S. and Australia and the U.K. And, you know, there's a book that I've got coming out in October and a graphic novel the following year. And there's a documentary and all kinds of other stuff in the works. There's we're now talking about a young readers edition, because if there's one group of people who'd really like a license to swear, it's teenagers. So I think that they're certainly on the front lines of this tech stuff and could benefit from a more nuanced analysis as well.
Yeah, I have been reading. I subscribe to some of your newsletters and stuff, and I've been reading your comments about why you're on certain platforms and why you have abandoned certain platforms. And I find it very compelling. In fact, because we're a publishing outlet, and because, you know, we have to put our stuff everywhere we can to try and get readers, I was on a number of social media channels and wound up canceling some of them, some of them because of who wound up owning them, but some of them also because of your insights and thinking about, okay, do I want to support a single company that can lock me in or lock me out, as the case may be, or do I want to do the Fediverse kind of thing where I'm in charge of my data and my readers? I think it's very insightful. The question I have is, okay, we've talked about it in terms of tech, but you just finished talking about climate and authoritarianism and so on and so forth, which certainly gets closer to what this podcast is supposed to be about, which is politics. How can you tie in inshittification with, say, climate?
Well, I mean, I guess there's a couple of different ways of making that connections. So the first thing I think you need to understand about inshittification is that while it is descriptive, it describes the decay of platforms, it also tries to make a causal analysis. Why are the platforms decaying? And it proposes that we've created what you might call an inshittogenic environment, an environment in which firms that take decisions that are harmful to their users and their suppliers are insulated from any consequence for those harms. And therefore, they are able to do things that are adverse to us and thrive as a result. And this, I think, is the answer to how is it that we had companies like Facebook, say, it's been owned by the same guy, you know, it's been a creep all along. If you read Sarah Wynne Williams's new book about Facebook, Careless People, you know, she's describing kind of larval Musk, or larval Zuck rather. And he's a jerk then, right? He didn't get a brain worm and turn bad. That's the guy who's in charge of the health service. This is, you know, he was always a bad person, but it's not your imagination, and you weren't a sucker to think that Facebook was good at one point, right? Mm-hmm. It was a place where we had a rather joyous and rollicking social round of people we cared about and people who cared about us and things we were interested in. Big, important movements cohered around it, whether that's Black Lives Matter or Me Too, political campaigns that were really important and made a difference. The Bernie Sanders campaign couldn't have existed without Facebook. So how is it that this guy, who was always terrible, used to do something that was good and then felt empowered to do this stuff that was so bad to us? And I think you got at the answer a little when you talked about lock-in. So certainly he bought a bunch of his competitors. Well, if you look at the record in the FTC case against Facebook that's underway now, you'll see that there's this juncture where they're buying Instagram And Mark Zuckerberg's CFO has written to him to say, Mark, why are you spending $1 billion of our shareholders' money buying a company with 12 employees? And Mark Zuckerberg writes back with admirable, if not well-advised, frankness, I am buying this company because people hate Facebook. They love Instagram. They're leaving Facebook for Instagram. If we buy Instagram, then when they leave Facebook, they'll still be Facebook users. Hmm. This is an actual admission of guilt. You know, the antitrust laws are sometimes a little hard to enforce because sometimes some aspects of them turn on whether a firm intended to reduce competition right. or create a monopoly. But every now and again, you get a CEO who sits down at his keyboard at 2 a.m. and writes, you know, dear Bob, regarding this killing we're planning, just so you know, it's a murder and it's premeditated. Yours truly, Mark Zuckerberg.
Right.
Right. And when that happened, nothing happened to Mark Zuckerberg as a consequence. The Obama mm-hmm. administration waved through the merger as all administrations have been waving through nearly all mergers for the past 40 years since kind of the Reagan revolution when we started dismantling antitrust law and allowing this. So they're not disciplined by competition. They're not disciplined by regulators. The regulators are quite captured. You know, in the United States, we haven't had a new consumer privacy law since 1988 when Ronald Reagan signed the Video Privacy Protection Act that bans video store clerks from telling newspapers which VHS cassettes you have. And so when Mark Zuckerberg spies on you using something other than the records of a video store, there are no consequences for him. We can't use technology to break free of Facebook. It is a felony under Section 1201 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act to change how the Facebook app works so that you can use a different app, but have it go into the Facebook app for you and grab the messages waiting for you and put them in your inbox somewhere else. And the tech workforce, which used to be quite a powerful workforce, even though they weren't unionized, but they were in such high demand, and they really did believe in their users, many of them, they lost their power too. We've seen supply catch up with demand and 500,000 tech layoffs in the last couple of years. And so, you know, tech workers don't tell their bosses that they refuse to enshittify their services. And so Mark Zuckerberg is able to run amok. And so when you look at these environmental aspects of enshittification, right? The collapse of antitrust, the capture of regulators, the neutering of trade unions and labor, and the mobilization of law against rivals and against people who would undo the mischief they've done. You get something that looks a lot like rising authoritarianism and the climate emergency, right? Yeah, we don't have the equivalent of the DMCA for you know, pig farming and CAFOs and stuff, but you do have ag gag laws where yes. giant companies capture their regulators, capture state governments, and make it a felony to go and look at what they are doing to animals in the environment. We do have regulatory capture even before the Trump switchover, but now very pronouncedly, where we have just the wholesale dismantling of environmental protection and environmental records. And it's not new. Like all the best Americans, I'm a Canadian. And, you know, a decade and a half ago, we had the Harper government in Canada. And Canada has got some pretty important environmental records, like the ship's logs that show the freeze and thaw dates of the Northwest Passage and the Arctic seas. And Stephen Harper, who owed his tenure to the oil patch, the Alberta tar sands, which is the dirtiest oil in the world, he ordered a rationalization of the National Archives in which all of these old materials would be digitized and burned. But they got the order wrong. So they burned them first.
I was waiting.
So, you know, hard to imagine that was an accident, right? It's pretty flimsy pretense. It's really, really kind of a raised middle finger. And so you see regulatory capture. You see the regulatory capture arising out of cartel-like behavior. So you have these giant oil firms that are nominally competitors, but who both figuratively and literally divide up the world and cooperate when it comes to talking to regulators and to working internationally on policy questions, treaties, and so on, who are allied in many cases with countries. So whether that's the Norwegian National Sovereign Wealth Fund or the Saudi royal family or what have you. So you have many of the same phenomena. And, you know, I think that the good news here is that we are seeing, we are able to see, if we look at this in the right way, that enshittification, the climate emergency, authoritarianism, they share a common root, which is the consolidation of power into unaccountable corporate hands. And, you know, that is a cause around which we can build coalitions of people who don't necessarily agree about a lot of other stuff. And so long as, you know, I'm okay marching alongside of you, so long as you believe that consolidation of power into unaccountable corporate hands is an existential risk. We don't have to agree about anything else, and we can be part of the same movement. And, you know, when coalitions form, that's when things change. That's why Trump is destroying the country right now, as he fused together a coalition of, you know, billionaires and eugenicists and, you know, bigots and misogynists and whatever, all these people who have different priorities, people who want to invade every country in the world, and people who want to be isolationists and not have America do any military ventures and still find themselves under Trump's big umbrella. I mean, Musk is the great example, someone who wants zero federal funding except when it comes to him,
right,
for any programs. And who, you know, is in coalition with, and, you know, as of about 3 a.m. last night, licking the boots of the Trump administration, which plans to, you know, add a gigantic amount of unfunded liabilities to the federal balance sheet.
Right. So let me ask you a philosophical question, and I don't want to chase this too far because I have some other questions to get to. Is this phenomenon of enshittification, is it a natural outcome of shareholder-driven capitalism, or is it a moral decision made by the people running the companies, or both?
Neither.
Okay.
So,
struck right out there now.
Yeah, I am not like a Hayek-pilled market purist who thinks that markets solve all of our problems, right? However, I do think that markets perform some pretty important, or competitive markets perform some pretty important functions, the most important of which is keeping firms at one another's throats so that they become governable, right? When I got started in tech policy, it was with the early copyright wars, with the Napster wars. And what you had then were like 100, 200 small and medium-sized tech companies, a couple of big guys, Microsoft and Intel, but for the most part, just these little companies. Now, in aggregate, those internet companies of the early years were worth like 10, 20 times what the entertainment industry was worth. But the entertainment industry was composed of seven companies.
Mm-hmm.
And the 200 companies couldn't agree on anything. Not only could they not agree on like what policy direction they wanted, they couldn't agree on where to hold a meeting to discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a cartel of seven firms find it really easy to come to a unity of purpose, not least because when a sector is that consolidated, you know, everybody in it has worked at all the firms in it, all the senior execs. And, you know, you look at Facebook and you see all these top Googlers in Facebook, and you look at Google and you see all these top Apple people, and you look at Apple and you see all these top Facebook people, mm-hmm. and they're like executors of each other's estates, they're godparents to each other's children, they're in the same polycules, they play golf together, right? They just know each other. You get a kind of emergent conspiracy out of every cartel. And so the decision to allow this market consolidation was a deliberate decision. It was promoted by a very fringe group of economists who later became the central or the economic orthodoxy, the Chicago School.
The Chicago.
And specifically out of a guy, viewers probably know, a guy called Robert Bork, who, you know, was Ronald Reagan's pick for the Supreme Court. And Bork, among many other things, like being the only lawyer working for Richard Nixon who was willing to illegally fire a bunch of his enemies, was also a crank when it came to antitrust. And he said that if you read the antitrust laws carefully enough, you will find that Congress never intended to prevent monopolies, that Congress loved monopolies because they're so efficient, and that the only thing Congress wanted is for monopolies not to abuse their power. And so long as monopolies were promoting the, quote, consumer welfare, that the government should not punish a monopoly. And he created a kind of tautological way of describing this, which is that if a company dominates its industry, it must be good. And the way that you can tell it's good is that it's dominating its industry, right? And so we had 40 years of non-enforcement in antitrust, right? We stopped enforcing anti-monopoly policy. We got monopolies. This shouldn't surprise anyone, right? This is like, we had a rat poison that we used to put down in the barn. We didn't have a rat problem. Along comes Robert Bork and says, we don't need the rat poison. So we stop putting it down. Now rats are like eating our faces off. And, these economists, they're like, well, how do you know that our rat problem is because we stopped putting down rat poison? Maybe it's sunspots, right? Maybe it's the time of the rat. And yeah, sure, all the rats went out. They bought the rat poison factories and shut them down. But surely you can see that that's economically rational if we're not going to put down rat poison anymore, right? So we created the environment in which firms could capture their regulators, and they did. And it's a flywheel because when you capture your regulators, you not only get to form monopolies and abuse your monopoly power, you also get to forestall other kinds of legislation like privacy laws or like environmental laws because the monopoly, the cartel, the duopoly is able to mobilize its policy preferences. And because they're not wasting their time with what Peter Thiel calls wasteful competition, they have lots of money they can spend realizing those policy preferences. So the issue is not that we have new bad people running companies, nor is it that shareholder capitalism inevitably leads to this, but rather that 40 years ago, we began on a path to taking sort of specific articulatable policies that produce this. It's not iron laws of economics. It's not the great forces of history, right? It is the decision to stop putting down rat poison that created the rat plague. And the good news is that means that like we know how to end it, right? We just have to put down rat poison. Problem is the rat shut down all the rat poison factories. So if you wanted to get there, I wouldn't start from here, but this is where we are.
So this, as I said earlier, this is supposed to be a podcast about politics. I sort of went out of my lane, as it were, to be able to interview you because, as I said, I just found the whole concept so fascinating. And I also, as I said, having read your Wikipedia page, I am completely in awe of all the work you've done. But I want to pull this now into this. Can we apply the concept of enchitification to politics, either in general or specific to American politics?
Well, enchitification, I'm fine with people using it in a kind of loose, non-technical sense to mean things getting worse. But enchitification, the way I lay out the thesis, relies on one very specific mechanism that is not obviously present in politics, which is the ability of digital systems to change the rules really quickly. So I call it twiddling. Right. So there are lots and lots of scams, right, out there in the world, including political scams. There's a specific kind of scam that tech companies do where every time you interact with them, the business logic of that interaction, right, the prices, costs, recommendations, search ranking, all of that stuff can be different and can be tailored to you. And so this makes it very hard for you to know when you're getting ripped off. And so I'll give you a couple examples of this. There's a company called Plexure that is in McDonald's investment portfolio. It's a startup McDonald's is invested in. And Plexure advertises that they can help people who operate drive-throughs reprice everything at the drive-through when you use your app to order something based on whether you've recently been paid. And so on the day you get paid, your breakfast sandwich costs more, right? Because you're spendier. It doesn't just affect the buy side, though. It affects the sell side. So nurses in this country now used to be booked through mostly staffing agencies or dozens and dozens of them. They were pretty much local. There are a few national ones, but mostly local. They've been all but obliterated by three giant apps. And the apps price nurse labor differently. From shift to shift and from nurse to nurse, based on whether you have a lot of outstanding debt, And so they're able to buy a nurse's credit history from a data broker before they offer them a shift and tighter the wage down based on how desperate, how economically desperate they think the nurse is. Right. Now, I've listened to Tennessee Ernie Ford songs. I know that we didn't just invent asshole bosses this week,
Right.
right? The thing is that if it's the 19th century, you just can't fill a boiler room with enough guys in green eye shades to do this trick, right? It's not that they like lacked the smarts, and it's not that they lacked the howling void where the rest of us have a moral center. They lack the technology. And in politics, we have lots of ways that politics gets worse, and some of them intersect with technology. Obviously, social media plays a pretty important role, and so on. And you do have this phenomenon, for example, where you may get a different political ad depending on your demographic characteristics, your behavioral characteristics. But in the main, politics doesn't have this advantage, right? A shell game, it's not sophisticated. Like if you've ever seen Penn and Teller do the cup and balls with clear cups, they do it really slowly. It's a great video. You'll know that it's not a very sophisticated trick, but when it's done very quickly, it's really hard to spot the ball, right? And what these digitally enabled firms and sectors are able to do is they're able to speed up their hands so that they operate at robot speeds. And that's the magic here. That's what's changing things. And so I don't know that I would call politics enshittified. I will say that there's lots of domains in which technology is protruding from the internet and into the physical world, right? Like, so grocery stores are increasingly using electronic shelf tags, so e-ink shelf tags that are networked and can be remotely updated. And Norway is where this kicked off. And in Norway, grocers change their prices between 2 and 3,000 times a day, right? And they say, oh, well, that's to help us move the wilted lettuce. But you can see how, when combined, especially with surveillance technology that can make guesses about your willingness to spend and other things, how that could be used to dynamically reprice things per shopper in ways that were extremely adverse to the shopper's interests.
I'm sitting here thinking about some areas of the political world, even in this state, but also, of course, in the country. And I'm thinking about ways that they could be described as enshittified. But I think your point about the interaction of the technology is an important caveat to that. So I'm not going to chase that too much further.
I mean, look, there's lock-in, right? I mean, people like gerrymandered districts mean that, the only way to cast a vote that matters is to do so in the primary, which is like a very weakly constituted institution relative to a general election, much more liable to corruption and kingsmanship and so on. So we do have like lock-in and its consequences. We do have people who become too big to fail and therefore too big to care. It's just this one specific mechanism that's missing.
I got you. I'd like to wrap up with a couple of things. You have a new book out, which I'm probably going to run by as soon as we get done. You've written a lot of books. Yes, Picks and Shovels. He has it right there. The man was prepared for the
Indeed, I got a stack of them here.
podcast. So I'm going to ask you a tough question. You've written a lot of books. Just for the sake of our listeners and viewers, if you had to pick one book to be buried with you that you would want to be remembered for, what book would that be?
Well, it's always the next book, right? That's the one that's the most exciting. So I just turned in what I think are the final edits on the Enshittification book that's coming out from Ferrar, Sturrus, and Giroux from Macmillan in October. I'm really happy with how this turned out. And that, they started sending out advanced review copies last month. There's a bunch of stuff I rewrote in light of Trump, as you might imagine.
Of course.
Everything changed, and I just did the edits I did today were literally about stuff that Trump was saying today, and it'll be out of the day tomorrow. But the early copies that are out there, just people are responding to it in a way that I've never had anyone respond to my work before. and I'm really excited about where this is going. But I sold another book to my publisher today. So
all right.
I a brief pamphlet called The Reverse Centaur's Guide to Criticizing AI, about how to be like a non-reactionary smart AI critic who aims your fire at things that improve people's material circumstances and not just, you know, not just makes you feel good because you dunked on some AI bro.
I'm already looking forward to that one as well. Okay, so my last question, I do this with candidates all the time, so I'm going to throw it your way. Let's suppose that I gave you a magic wand and you had one or two, I'll give you two wishes with this magic wand. What would you use it for to slow down enchidification? Or I'll put a different spin on it. What can we do to slow down enchidification?
Well, what can we do is a good one, because we, you know, one of us can do anything, but these are policy questions. And so you don't solve them by shopping better, right? You know, you're not going to shop your way out of a monopoly. It's notoriously difficult to do, right? But as you know, as a policy matter, you know, your politics podcast, you probably know this landmark 2014 study that showed that when billionaires and everyday people have different policy priorities, no matter how popular this is among everyday people, the billionaires always win. You know this, the 2700 policy outcomes studied, and every case where it was billionaires versus the public, the billionaires won. The only one that that's not true of is antitrust. We've had 5 years of amazing, amazing antitrust revival in Canada, the US, China, the European Union, Australia, Japan, South Korea. Like, everyone has started to figure out that concentrated corporate power is really dangerous. And so that's great. And, you know, I assume that the majority of the people watching here don't identify as Republicans, but some of them might. There is a strong antitrust tendency within the Republican Party. Most of them are people I have no time for on any other issue and disagree with vehemently. But this is an issue that they largely agree on, which is quite interesting. I think they agree for the same reason Xi Jinping is chasing down tech bosses in China, which is that they see these large firms as rivals for state power. That's what they are, right? And in terms of one thing I would change, there's this 1998 law, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Section 1201 of the DMCA makes it a felony to change a digital lock. So if there's something in a device or a service that's designed to stop you from changing how it works, you can't bypass it, even if you don't break the law. So if your printer is designed so that it checks to see whether the cartridge came from the manufacturer and it's not a remanufactured cartridge, then it's a felony punishable by a 5-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine to disable that software, even though using ink of your choosing is not a crime, right? The removing the lock is a crime. It's felony contempt of business model. And this is why farmers can't fix their tractors. It's why hospitals can't fix their ventilators. It's why the mechanics can't fix your car. It's why you can't use a third-party app store on your iPhone or your Xbox, and why Apple gets to take 30 cents out of every dollar you spend in every app. So every news outlet that's getting a subscription through Apple is having 30 cents out of every dollar scraped by Apple for processing a payment, something that, you know, costs everyone else between 1% and 3%.
Right.
Unless it's in an app. I would just get rid of this law. I mean, it's outrageous, right? Like, you know, the fact that you can't change your printer so it takes third-party ink is why the printer companies have raised the price of ink over and over again. And now ink is the most expensive fluid you can buy as a civilian without a permit. You spend more than $10,000 a gallon on ink. The colored water that you print your grocery list with costs more than the semen of a Kentucky Derby winner, right? And so, you know, it feels like a no-brainer to get rid of this law. Like, there's no good reason for it. I'm quite hopeful, actually, that other countries will get rid of this law. Because what's happened over the last 20 years is the U.S. government got all of America's trading partners to agree to pass this law. And the difference is that, like, those countries don't really have companies that use these locks, right? Because they're not, like, big tech powerhouses like America. It's really just America. So not only are their people's pockets getting picked, like Americans are, but also their stock market isn't being buoyed up by the, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars that are being stolen from people using this scam. So I just get rid of this law. It shouldn't be there. It's long past its sell date. I think other countries are going to contemplate getting rid of it. The only reason they passed it is because the U.S. Trade Representative said that there would be tariffs on their exports when they went to America if they didn't pass this law. And now, like, whatever, right? Like, you know, Trump is horrible, but like when life gives you SARS, you make sarsaparilla. And the fact that, you know, he's taken away the single best weapon the U.S. Trade Representative had to arm twist other countries into arranging their affairs to benefit American firms, which was the threat of tariffs, right, means that there's no reason for other countries to keep doing this, which is, you know, a silver lining.
Yes. All right. Cory Doctorow, thank you. I'd like to wrap up by you telling us where we can find you. If people want to subscribe to your work or get your newsletter or read your stuff, where should they go?
Sure. Well, my books are mostly published by Macmillan. Various imprints tour for Arsreshi Roo and First Second do my graphic novels. You just put my name into any bookstore. If you're in around Cincinnati, Joe Beth does a pretty good job of stocking my books. But, you know, obviously internet bookstores have them as well. In terms of finding my stuff online, I work for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. That's EFF.org. And my newsletter is at pluralistic.net, and that's got feeds that go out as Twitter threads, as Mastodon threads, on Medium, on Tumblr, as a newsletter. All of the links to subscribe, however you want to subscribe on whatever platform you're on, you can find at the top of the page at pluralistic.net. And it's Creative Commons licensed, so you can take it, you can reprint it, you can sell it, you can translate it. All you need to do is follow the license terms that say you have to credit it to me and reproduce right. The license with it. There's no tracking. So I don't have any trackers. I don't know how many people visit my website. I don't keep logs. It's just black type on a white screen. My privacy policy is I don't collect your data and I don't use it in any way ever.
Right. All right. I will put links to all of those in the description. And I really appreciate you taking your time. This has been fascinating and insightful, which is what I knew it would be. Thank you again.
Well, thank you, Bruce. I appreciate it.